I'm James Edmondson, and this is Ono Radio. Today, we're talking to one of my favorite people of all time, Bob Offaldish. When I was in my very first year of design school at California College of the Arts in San Francisco, another one of my favorite people, Angie Wang, was my Typography 1 teacher. And she just knew that I'd love Bob, and she implored me to take his class. I ended up having Bob as an instructor for 2 different semesters in my undergrad, and it was a very big deal to me. Bob ended up becoming a sort of role model for his design sensibilities, his sense of humor, being an educator, a lot of different things. Everyone loves Bob. So the question becomes, well, how do we be more like Bob? I don't think I know, but it's a good thing to imagine. To quickly go over his bio, Bob is primarily a print designer, he's a husband, a father of 2, he's designed type, identities, tons and tons of books, he's fond of wearing a striped shirt with a striped tie, he is absolutely, disarmingly unpretentious and talented, which is one of my favorite combinations. Bob's a member of the AGI, but like he would never mention it, you know what I'm saying here? When I was in school, Bob began his class by saying, "This is supposed to be fun." And that idea has echoed in my brain since taking this class. And it's basically become the mission statement for our Type Foundry. Bob came to my garage studio for the first ever live recording of this podcast. And he brought me flowers. I hope you enjoy this conversation with my hero, Bob Offaldish. Okay, Bob.
All right.
James. Thank you for coming and being
Hell yes.
My garage for the first in real life version of this podcast. And to just bring the listener up to speed, I've had the pleasure of knowing you for like over 10 years.
Already? God.
But it even goes back further than that, because I was thinking about it, and my first interaction with CCA, which was where I got my undergrad, California College of the Arts, I sent away for a course catalog, and that was the first thing I saw from CCA, and it was so cool, just the graphic design of it, that I was like, here, like, this is the place that I want to go. And, you know, I had photographs of the college and everything, but I didn't tour the school. Like, I just saw that. I thought it was great. I applied, got in, and paid my tuition and showed up on the first day. And I was in San Francisco and never thought to, like, go tour the college or anything like that. And it was something that you designed, I think.
Was it like a sort of vaguely oversized thing, or was it a tiny thing?
It was a pamphlet. It was okay. Like a saddle stitch catalog. And it was very Bob in its design, with a lot of gradients and squiggles and interesting...
I think I know the one.
Yeah. ...motifs. Yeah, so this is like 2007, 2008 era.
Uh-huh. And it used Eidetic by Rod. Rod's typeface.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, totally. So I just thought, like, man, that's kind of amazing, because if that catalog would have been horrible or didn't look captivating in some way, maybe I wouldn't have even thought to go there in the first place.
Huh. Of course, it's also interesting to think of how many people that scared away. It's like, these people, forget it.
I was thinking about that because Sadie is now helping us out with our social media, and she showed me on Instagram, she's like, hey, look, this is how you can tell how many followers you lose every day. And it's like barely more than we gain every day, so we're net positive. But and it's just something I had not even thought about. So you actually
might be right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think most people would have been like me in that situation, who would just see something designed. And at that point in my life, like, I hadn't really seen that much stuff that I thought was great or that moved me mm-hmm. in that way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
I don't know. What was your kind of first experience of getting moved by graphic design in a similar way?
Oh, boy. I mean, probably through magazines and stuff. Because, you know, I grew up in the 70s. So there was no Instagram followers.
Right.
Or social media or any of that. Or computers. Like Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
National Geographic.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
And then...
And album covers, of course.
Yeah, album covers seem to be, like, the cool way of getting into graphic design.
Yeah, in our class, if you didn't know what to do that week, you'd, like, make an album cover for some band that didn't exist.
Uh-huh. You know? And this was in your undergrad at Kent State?
No, this was in high school.
Oh, in high school. You're doing graphic design stuff in high school?
Well, it wasn't framed that way.
Uh-huh.
But... I mean, I did do graphic design when I worked at the school's newspaper.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, back then everything was done by hand. And so to make lots of issues, we like did all the paste up and we'd like type the articles on an IBM Selectric and Xerox them down and, and all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, that's graphic design.
Totally.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously all this stuff about your background, I feel like it's really well covered. And
yeah, go wherever you want.
Well, I was reading, like I was saying, the Eric Hyman interview with you this morning, and I was like, wow, it's kind of amazing to get this refresher, and because no one's really doing like maybe that level of research on their professors when they're just going to college. Like I remember we would just like look at your websites and stuff like that. And then in studio talk about which teacher had the coolest kind of website and portfolio and stuff. And then I looked at your portfolio this morning. I was like, oh my God, this is like its own Wikipedia. It is massive. You have so many projects on there.
Well, I'm from the he can do this stuff already. No shit. Just stop worrying. Make the call. I'm here. I'm waiting. Come on already.
I mean, there's dozens of things on there. Yeah, that must have taken forever to produce.
Yeah, and I had a WordPress site that got hacked and like someone called and says, hey, did you know you're selling Viagra on your website now? I was like, no, but if I get a cut, then maybe I'd be okay with this. But, and the people who were doing the hosting, they couldn't like clear it out and it just wouldn't go away. And that kept happening again and again. And all the functionality kept getting like, so eventually I just made a Squarespace thing and had to rebuild it from scratch.
God.
So I don't have all the older things that were on the old website back on the new sites. So I'm just sort of moving forward.
Mm-hmm. So many books. I mean, just to finish one book is like a Herculean effort. And to have something signed off and to have it go to press just feels like monumental, and there's a lot of money at stake, and these things are not cheap and stuff.
Oh yeah, the printing for these things is like whatever the design fee is. You know, people complain like they're paying the designer too much, and it's like you're gonna spend $100,000 on the printing,
right?
Like, stop it.
Yeah, and these are like really beautiful, often photo books, so the printing has to be like really dialed in and everything. And you have a book thing. Like, you kind of have this obsession with books that I thought was normal in school. Well, a lot of people have that sort of book obsession when you're thinking about CCA faculty or kind of just like a love for that kind of intimacy, right, and what the paper feels like and like we said, how the book smells and stuff like that. Graduating from CCA, moving on to other parts of my life, it was so cool to get reacquainted with your love of books through your Bob's Bookshelf series. So what is that and how did that come about?
So the college is back to being sort of in person. They're calling it hybrid. So like when we were in class together, it was 6 hours a week in studio. So this hybrid thing is 4 hours a week. But we're still, as faculty, sort of responsible for 6 hours of what I jokingly call programming. And, you know, asking around with everybody, it's like, well, what are you going to do? And everyone's just kind of dumbfounded. Like, I don't know. Uh-huh. You know, because obviously we're freaked out. Like, how are we going to get through everything in 4 hours when we used to have six?
Right.
And they're like, we'll record all your lectures. And it's like, this is a studio class.
Yeah.
There's no lecture. I mean, usually as you well know, I stand up in the front of the room and wave my arms around a lot and hope for the best. So so like part of it I'm taking care of by like having an office hour by Zoom, which is a safe bet because, you know, the students are probably never going to come to that. But I can say I've fulfilled my obligation. And then the other thing I thought of is like, well, let's do things where I can like show a book and talk about it in detail.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we might not have time in class to do that.
Right.
And when I thought of the idea and started making them, I wasn't sure how comfortable everyone was going to be in the classroom. Like, because we have to wear masks in the building. And I didn't know, like, are all the students going to scatter to the corners of the room and try to be all far apart? And I'd be standing up there with this book and no one can see it. So I thought, okay, I'll figure out how to make a video of these things.
Yeah. So the video, I mean, the two that I saw, maybe that's all that have been uploaded so far.
There's three now.
There's three. Okay. They're so great. And really, even the production quality, I was super impressed with. You have like a multi-camera thing going on.
Oh, yeah.
And like lighting is good and your titles look cool. And you're using typefaces that came out within the last couple of years, which I'm always impressed
by. Wait, where was that?
That's you were using White from Dynamo, right? Maybe not.
Maybe not.
Maybe I spotted it wrong.
The big chunky things are
Knockout,
our older Champion.
Oh, nice.
Well, when they expanded that family to this enormous thing, and it's like, I'm not gonna spend all that because I know which like five I like, and the five I like are from Champion. And then there is a newer one, and I'm sorry, I forget what it is.
Hey,
but it's, you know how it is, it's like, what did I, you can in the font management software I use, you can say sort by date added.
Okay.
And every once in a while I'd be like, all right, let's just look at the type that way this time. And just go to the top of the list, what did I buy most recently? That looks pretty good.
That's an actually interesting way of approaching that type selection problem. I've never heard of anyone else doing that.
Yeah. Well, hopefully the students don't listen, because we're at the point in the project where they're supposed to be very carefully considering their typeface selections, and it should not be like what I bought yesterday. Yeah.
Or maybe, I don't know. I think there's something to it. But the point that I'm trying to make is, I love Bob's Bookshelf. Is this something that's available to, I mean, I watched it on YouTube with no password or anything, so.
Yeah, it's, well, for all the college stuff, we have to use Moodle. So, and only the students in my class can access the class Moodle, and that's where those are. And I was telling somebody else about this, and they were like, oh, well, I want to see that. And I was like,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So I put them on. I'm putting them on YouTube.
It's so great, and I'm so glad that you're doing that, because, I mean, if I'm allowed to share it, like, I would share away. Awesome, because I want to be like. This was a really pivotal thing for me to see someone talk about books or whatever in this way, where you can kind of go through it, see how someone is using a grid, kind of see how they start messing with the grid. Just talk about all of these design decisions with chapter title, what's half title, full title, what the folios are doing. And it was just like
nerdy stuff.
Yeah. Well, it is the nerdy stuff. It's also just like the mechanics of it in, a really easy way to understand if someone is explaining it to you like that. If you're not thinking about it in that way, it would be easy for the whole process to just be a mystery in this like bewildering kind of way.
Yeah.
But hearing you talk about it and just feeling your love for it is so great. And it's so genuine, especially when you say stuff like, I keep this book by my bed, the type history book, not because I want to get bored by it to the point that I fall asleep, but in hopes that I might dream about type.
That is literally something you said in there.
Yep.
That is so great. That's amazing to me.
That's a great book. Oh my God, that book is so great. Do you have that book?
I don't have the book.
Oh my God.
No. Say the title and the author for people.
It's Paul McNeil from Muir McNeil, and the book is called, I think, The Visual History of Type or something. It's basically the history of type through type specimens. I get chills. I'm getting chills thinking about this book. It's such a great book.
That's totally my point, which is, how long have you been doing this? Awfulish Warner started 1990?
Yep.
Okay, so 31 years into that. And you want to dream about type. Like, I don't know if I really have a fear of losing, of falling out of love with graphic design or type design or whatever. But it's definitely crossed my mind.
Oh, like, sure.
Oh, shit, what if I wake up one day and I don't like this stuff anymore? What do I do then? Seems like it hasn't...
I figured that's what the wood shop's for.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Pretty much. You could
have a cabinetry company with the best swag anywhere.
I think it's... how you are with books is how I am with tools, I think. Like, it's a really deliberate thing that stuff is here to sustain my interest in it. And it feeds back into what I'm doing in kind of different ways. But it just made me so happy to know that someone 30 years in to an industry that, you know, can be at times a little bit soul crushing if we're talking about like endless client revisions the stress or money issues or whatever, and running a freelance business, you know, you're introduced to the whole other business end of these things. But you've fallen out of love with it zero, from what I can tell.
Well, it's not like there's not dark moments. You know, I spent all of last weekend working on something, and on Saturday morning I thought, oh my God, I got nothing. And by Sunday afternoon I was like, I'm a genius. And I sent them the PDF, and by Monday afternoon it was like, oh my God, I got nothing.
Oh gosh.
So, you know, those kinds of things don't help. But what I focus on is that initial process. Uh-huh. It's like what happens once the work goes to the people who it's for, and maybe it just dies a horrible death. Mm-hmm. That's kind of out of my control. But what's in my control is the ability to like make something that I'm still happy with. That's all you got, really. So as long as I am able to keep coming up with that stuff that pleases me or surprises me or delights me, then I'm good. If it never sees the light of day, that's frustrating, and that definitely falls under the soul-crushing category. But, you know, if I was making crap and the crap was all going out, I think that would be different. I mean, at least I'd pay the mortgage, but, you know, that would be really hard.
Okay, talk to me a little bit about teaching, because from the little teaching that I've done, it's, you know, you find yourself saying the same things over and over. And
it's like being a parent.
Yeah. It's true. It's hard to refresh it or breathe new life into it or say the same thing in a way that still kind of expresses your enthusiasm for it. So how long have you been teaching, first of all?
30 years at the college, and I taught for 3 years as a graduate student.
So the teaching has been going longer even than you've been working as a professional.
No, because there was a 4-year break when I finished grad school, and I worked. That's the only time I've ever had a normal job in design. And then I went back to teaching.
But this has just been like...
It's been a constant throughout. Yeah.
Of your kind of life, but also kind of your creative practice in one way or another. So, like, why?
Well, I mean, when I was a grad student, the why was pretty simple. It's like, here's the deal. You get to go to grad school for free.
Yeah.
We give you a studio, and we give you a stipend that you'll barely be able to live on. And in exchange, you're going to teach these classes. And by teach, I mean like teach, like the guy in the front of the room, not like the TA who takes attendance and then goes out and smokes cigarettes. It's like you're the person. So that's how it started. And honestly, when I was done, I was like, I am never doing this again. It was so hard.
The first semester.
When I was a grad student. Because I was barely older than the students.
Yeah.
I probably looked younger than them then. And also, I went to grad school at the same place I went to undergrad school. So, you know, I'm sure there were people who were like, wait, that guy? You've got to be kidding me.
But did you deal with that in class? Or were there kind of...
Like... I just pretended it didn't exist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, they would have us teach in the foundation program. And, you know, certainly I felt like a complete fraud standing up there. But then it was like, well, wait, this thing that I'm talking about, I did 4 years ago. I've completely absorbed it.
Right.
So, you know, you slowly realize that, well, I guess I know a few things. And if I can figure out how to bring people through this process, it'll work. And it did. So I just faked my way through it, pretended it wasn't a problem.
Yeah.
And then when I came back to teaching, that story is that, the real job I had was working for Steve Tollison.
Okay.
Whose studio is still running in the city. Fantastic studio. And Steve was an adjunct at CCAC. And every once in a while, he'd be not into going and teaching his class. And he'd be like, well, you go. You know, you probably know how to do this better than me. He'd go, just show up.
He would just throw you in as an unannounced sub?
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. And I'd be like, well, what's happening today? What's the goal? And he's like, oh, they're just supposed to have sketches for whatever it is.
Okay.
So I'd go in and I'd be like, hi, I'm Bob. I'm really sorry. Steve can't be here today, but he sent me to help you however I can. So he said, we're going to do desk crits. And they're like, okay. They just immediately accepted it.
Yeah.
That was so weird to me. Like, isn't there going to be a riot?
Yeah. Yeah.
But get this guy out of here.
That is the weirdest thing, is when you're the teacher or you're the parent or the adult in the room to whatever extent.
Yeah.
People kind of get on board with it and
it's
sort
really
of like
weird.
Go with the program.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
So what were those teaching experience? Were you like, oh man, this is awesome. I love this. I want to keep it going.
It was great. Yeah. The students were amazing. You know, this is back when the sort of the demographics of the students who were in the program were a little different. So it was before there was, like, everybody had a grad program for design. So people who were looking to do, like, a career move, and they were in San Francisco or in the Bay Area and didn't want to, like, relocate to Southern California or go to Cranbrook or whatever, they would just do another undergrad in our program. So you'd have people where they're like, yeah, I was halfway through a master's in psychology and I decided to change my mind and go into design. So you've had these like amazingly smart, super motivated and mature people. And the work and the work ethic was just mind-boggling.
Was that the bulk of the class at that point?
It seemed like it, but probably not. I mean, I don't know.
Well, when I was going there, it seemed to be like a lot of transfer students like that. I know I was a transfer student and coming in around the time I was like 25 or maybe a little bit younger than that, but definitely not fresh out of high school or anything. There were some of those people. And then there were a couple of international students and, that sort of thing. But there was a lot of seriousness in the classroom and not too many people just kind of treating it as a joke or a walk in the park or something, which as an outsider who had never had any, I never stepped foot in an art school before. I was like, well, it's art school. You know, what?
How hard can this be?
Exactly. And then you quickly get confronted with the kind of time requirements. And I was psyched to to kind of get that and to know that, yeah, there was a ton of time required, but it wasn't like you were going to be reading the Iliad 4 hours a night. It was just doing the stuff that, exactly the sort of stuff that I wanted to learn and get better at and and talk about in class. And then at some point early on, like graphic design one for me, people start throwing around this name, Bob Offaldish, which is like, what, whose name is Bob? Like, what a crazy name to have. And then,
it's
was like,
funny name.
Oh, James, you are clearly interested in having a sense of humor. You should talk to Bob, or you should take Bob's class, or you should see what's going on with Bob. And this is mostly coming from Angie Wang at that
point. Type Angie and Mark are like my feeders. They siphon certain kinds of people in my direction.
They definitely did that for me. And I think the first thing that the first encounter I had with you in a classroom setting was Sputnik, I think, because I had you for graphic design 4 too, but I think Sputnik might have come first.
Possibly. Yeah.
And because you have kind of like taught everything now at this point, everything in type and graphic design and Sputnik, which is now called something else, or there's a different studio name for it.
Yeah, now it's TBD and Eric runs it and the focus has shifted completely.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I see. Yeah, so anyways, I remember the first day of graphic design class with you. You said, this is supposed to be fun. And do you start every class with that? Is that the first day of class, like a bullet point for you every time?
I've gotten out of the habit of doing that, and I don't know why, but I should definitely get back.
It was huge
to doing that.
It was huge for me, and I've talked about it
doing that
a bunch since. And I think I've thought kind of back on it in my memory enough times to probably totally misconstrue your original intention or like your explanation of it. But as I remember it, you were like, listen, this is supposed to be fun. We are not here to, you know, we're not studying investment banking. if this is the kind of thing you're getting into to make the most amount of money you possibly can, or whatever, you might be in the wrong program. And
not to mention the wrong school.
So the reason we're here is to have fun. And if you're not doing that, if that's not unfolding in that way for you, you need to make a change and do something differently. Either approach the problem in a different way, but I think you said, like, have a conversation with me about it.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy shit. Like, that's so amazing to hear. And I remembered it in that moment and have obsessed about it. And it's kind of become a mission statement of, like, my creative practice now and my company. But is that kind of accurate to your description of this is supposed to be fun?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because it is. It's supposed to be fun. I mean, there's so many other things you could do with your life. I mean, and I guess it's not like we're the only ones having fun here. You know, I mean, if you're into numbers and you want to be like an accountant and that's like your thing,
right,
then hell yeah, do that.
Yeah.
So I guess I use it as a way to help people just sort of orient themselves. And plus, people can get so serious, and certainly, you know, as the specter of student debt hovers over everyone in a different kind of way.
Yeah.
Than it used to. Like, I graduated with no debt whatsoever.
Yeah, I did too.
You know, it's a different thing when it's like, you know, there's all that money hanging over you. Like, I had a conversation with a student earlier this week who didn't feel like they were doing well, and they were kind of freaked out, and they kept saying, you know, it's so much money.
Yeah.
And I was like, gosh, shit, Jesus. Right. I mean, it used to be people could put off thinking about, like, the giant bag of money hanging over their head, at least till they graduated.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm talking to a student in level 2 who's freaked out about that. God, I just felt for this person.
I know. And then what's the solution to it? Do you just say, like, I know it's a ton of money, but don't worry about it. Worry about it later. I don't know.
I mean, there is no good answer.
Yeah.
For that. Because it is. It is a lot of money. You know. I mean, to be honest about, like, how much money college costs, our younger daughter wasn't super ready for, like, full-on college, so...
Out of high school, because who the hell is?
Who the hell knows? Yeah. And like, my wife and I were useless for our daughters when it came to this, because we knew what we wanted to do. So it's so easy, right? If you're in Northeast Ohio and all you can afford is a state school and you want to be a graphic designer and you don't want to be too far away from home, it's like, you're going to Kent State, buddy. That's it. Plus, they'll take you. So that's super easy. But if you're from Northern California and you're interested in a lot of things and like, what do you do?
Yeah.
So I tell people, community college
is
so great. Like, I remember my wife was signing up our daughter for class and you know, made some kind of payment. And my wife said to the person, all right, so when is the tuition due?
That's it.
And the person on the phone was like, you just paid it. And she's like, well, no, really, how much is it?
So that's what happened. She ended up going to community college.
Yeah, she's doing community college off and on, and she works these things out.
Uh-huh.
And work these things out. And I don't know. I just think, like, you went to CCA when you were 25.
Yeah.
That's a completely different thing. Like, you were able to work some stuff out.
Totally.
You knew what direction you were pointed, and once you were there, you went, and boom, off it goes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel for people who are just sort of flailing around and racking up debt.
Right.
That's just terrifying to me.
The debt thing is something I was encountering in the type design class I was teaching at CCA in the grad department, because
they pay even more.
Do they?
Yeah.
Tuition's even more expensive. I mean, what is it for a year at CCA? 40 grand or something like that?
Something like that. I try not to know.
Good strategy.
I mean, not because I'm an irresponsible jerk, just because it's like, wow.
Yeah. Well, I remember in class, we'd talk about it, and we'd start doing the math and see what it costs per minute to be in studio, you know? And then people would still, like, skip class. It was rare. That didn't happen a lot, really. But every time someone did that, I'd be like, you just lost $400 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But yeah, I touched on some opinions on debt that I have in that type design class. And
it was like, all of a sudden, all the students started paying attention to me for the first time in the semester, because I was talking about something they seemed to care a lot more about than type design in that moment. And I was like, okay, well, this is maybe something I should come back to. And then I tried to...
The type design or the debt?
The debt. I was like, you guys don't want to be here for type design. Or maybe some of you do. Teaching electives is hard because...
Oh, my God.
You sign up, you don't know what it is, and you don't know if you're really interested in it. And that was a hard class to teach straight up. Teaching at Type West through the Letterform Archive and stuff, completely different.
Right, because those people are like laser focused.
Yeah, they're on board from the get-go.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm probably selling them a little bit short. I had a number of awesome students in there that did fantastic work. But when I put together my debt presentation, it was a different level of attention. And I just wanted to express to them that, like, you know, investing in your education is, like, always a good idea, because you're always going to get something out of it. It might not be exactly the thing that the curriculum is designed to teach, but you're going to meet someone, you're going to love a teacher, you're going to, you know, have enriching experiences in a lot of different ways in any classroom environment. Especially, in my opinion, real life classroom environments. It's just way easier to facilitate that stuff. So that was the thing that I wanted to say, is to not let the fear of debt kind of crushed their decision. And then also, students are at such an advantage because they're all broke and they're all used to living like a broke student. So the longer you can prolong that, you can be pretty aggressive with how you pay off your debt. But the thing that I was seeing when I was graduating was the really killer students that were kind of like top of the class people, you know, went to Facebook or Dropbox or Pinterest or whatever. And of course they did, because they give you lunch, they have snacks, incredible benefits, good pay, and you're able to get rid of your debt way faster than you would if you're working in whatever tiny design agency that maybe wouldn't afford to pay you that same sort of salary. But do you have those conversations with students, first of all?
Not so much.
About what they're going to do after they graduate?
In thesis, we do talk to them about that sometimes. When, like, if someone's trying to figure out what direction to take their project, sometimes the conversation might be about, well, do you have a sense of what kind of job you want? Because all things being equal, if the project can sort of tee you up for some kind of thing that's going to look good when you're looking for a certain kind of job, I'm totally on board with helping you make your project go that way. If it doesn't matter either way, then fine. Then I think what this other idea might be better. So we do talk to them about it in that way, but there's no like presentation on you know, here's how you should structure your finances so that you can pay off your debt. Although the word that we've given the thesis students this semester is economy.
So the backstory there is every year or every semester for thesis, they get a different word to work off of. Mine was work.
What's going on under there?
Oh, I hit a drawer and it started moving and I was...
fine, it's fine.
Okay.
Thought there was a spider down there or something.
No, I'm used to... spiders are no problem for me.
There's a couple of them out here. Yeah, so they get economy and that's... then they go into whatever direction. You're teaching thesis this year?
Yeah, with Leslie Becker.
And nice. And it's hybrid also?
Kind of. We have... half the class is only via Zoom on Thursday nights, and that's for the people who are in other faraway time zones. Because on Thursday night, I guess that's like Friday morning in the East. And then on Friday mornings, we're in person at the college for a completely different group of students.
So,
but they all have the same word to deal with.
Teaching something like thesis versus teaching something like type 2, like you could say that maybe the results of type 2 are going to be a little bit more expected than what happens in thesis. Does it have any impact on your enjoyment of the teaching experience?
No, because it's so different. Like type class is all about, you know, macro and micro and macro and micro and macro and micro, back and forth, back and forth. And they've never done this before, so you're sort of guiding them along. The thesis students, this is their last thing they do before they're out, usually. And so they're bringing more to the table. So it's more of a conversation, and, you know, it's not like I have to do demos in thesis class. It's like, here's how to set up your InDesign document, kids.
Yeah, that's nice to get rid of that
stuff. Yeah, you don't need to do any of that. And it's sort of, it's mostly, you know, just, it's fun talking to people, right? And it's like, it's their thing. So if they're not stoked, it's like, well, that's not on me. I mean, in type two, I can get if, like, maybe you're not interested in books or you're not interested in systems or you're not interested in typography. Fine.
Yeah.
But in thesis, if you're not interested in your project, well, you pitched it. I mean, come on.
It's such a crazy range of emotions in that class. Or I'm sure whatever, you know, call it thesis or call it whatever, I mean, final project.
Yeah, any regular graphic design program would call this senior project.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because it's not graduate.
Like, and it's, you know, obviously student directed, and the just roller coaster of emotions you see in there is just unlike anything.
Right.
I remember vividly people freaking out and having minor panic attacks and just floundering in there, because it is one of the first times where you really have to take ownership of the beginning to end of the project.
Right.
But I think CCA is really great about kind of injecting a lot of student-driven stuff along the way, so you're not, like, thinking, oh, this is the first time that I have to express my point of view on this stuff, or... I at least kind of remember a lot of teachers saying, okay, well, what do you care about? Or what's the thing that you're into? And I would always think, like, well, that's the first time a teacher's ever asked me that. What do I care about? What political issues do I care about? You know, I don't know. But that's really cool. And then thesis, like, it just all kind of comes together. My thesis experience was like, I was so scared of that and the staying up all night kind of thing where
Right, you mentioned in another podcast that the staying up all night thing is like, can't do it.
I can't do it. Have you ever done it?
I've done it once or twice.
In your life?
In my life. And only as a student.
Yeah, it's not cool. It's very romanticized. But...
oh, yeah. Because after I pulled one of the all-nighters, I had to drive somewhere on the freeway, and I was having like little mini blackouts.
Oh,
I'd like,
God.
You know, I'd like nod off and wake up in another lane. Fortunately, in Ohio, they have big freeways, and not, there isn't always a lot of traffic on them. Here, you'd be killed instantly.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And it's not like it doesn't happen, whatever. So, terrible. We've established that.
Yes. No all-nighters.
I was so scared of that that I just tried to finish the project as soon as possible. I way overshot the mark. I finished
You were done at midterm.
Yeah.
I remember that film was so great. And the car wash thing?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That was so
great. I'm amazed that you would remember any thesis presentation at all. That's wild to me.
Well, I generally don't remember the midterms. And I wasn't even teaching that semester.
Right.
I was just a guest.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, I'm sorry to say, I don't even remember what you did for the final.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
it was basically a project. Now that I think about it, I can't believe I got away with it.
What you can get if the students, they'll never learn. I always tell them, go to the midterm and go to the final before you're in the class.
Yeah.
So that you know what's coming. Because if they knew what we would roll with, it's like, oh, you want to do that? Yeah. All right. Sure. See what happens.
This thing that's just barely rooted in graphic design at all.
Yeah.
Like, it's actually completely a performance or something else entirely. Like, it's all good. It's
on. Absolutely.
Yeah, I made a film basically about how I wanted to be a type designer. and that was it. All right. Well, thesis and teaching and everything is just stuff, or you as a teacher is stuff that I haven't really thought about a ton beyond this thing of this is supposed to be fun and stuff like that. And the volume of work that you would make us create too was always kind of crazy. You know, this like 50-part poster series
type. Oh, that was Eric's idea.
Of course it was.
No, honestly, it was. Eric and I met at Green Apple Books to hang out, and then we went across the street to a Chinese restaurant and drank tea all afternoon and wrote notes. And as the further we got into the afternoon, the more insane the class became.
Yeah.
And
This is also when you made us do a graphic response to Sharky's Night. Yeah.
Yeah. William Burroughs sings over a Laurie Anderson song. Yeah.
That was, without a doubt, the weirdest graphic design assignment I ever got. And I remember watching this performance of Sharky's Night. I doubt anyone listening to this podcast knows this reference, but if you want to be freaked out by some 80s avant-garde music performance,
put Laurie on Laurie Anderson. Little,
yeah.
Fantastic artist.
Yeah. I think my response was very, very underwhelming, but
just a warm-up project.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so another thing that's like a big CCA thing in my mind, I guess a lot of graphic design programs probably do this too, but we had to make everything. Like, take our own photos, make our own illustrations and stuff, make whatever icons needed for whatever identity project. And then that's also something that you kind of list on your website as like a special kind of quality that you bring to the table, that you're an image maker too. Mm-hmm. So where does that whole thing come from? Was that part of your education?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I've only had one photography class, but it was built into the curriculum of my major.
Had one photography class?
Uh-huh.
You're pretty into photography.
Well, that class came at a moment in the curriculum when they were piling all this other stuff on us.
Uh-huh.
That, in retrospect, was designed to make people discouraged and get them to go away.
Uh-huh.
It was like a shakeout semester.
That's what I feel like Eric Hyman did to me, by the way, and all of us, you know. But yeah, so they tried to shake you out and you stayed with it.
Well, and I didn't do well that semester, but I was in this photo class, and there was something really deeply meditative about making black and white prints.
Uh-huh.
It's very process-oriented. Mm-hmm. If you do everything right, at the end, you'll have this thing that you're responsible for, that you created.
Uh-huh.
It's deeply, deeply satisfying in a way that the stuff we were having us do in graphic design at that moment was not. So I would just hide in the dark room.
Uh-huh.
Because I could rationalize blowing all this time because it takes a long time to make a good print. And now that I've made one, why don't I make another one for my folks?
Uh-huh.
Or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And so anyway, that was built into the program.
Uh-huh.
To learn to take pictures. And then, you know, there would be assignments where you would have to, like, you know, make a poster or something. But you had to, like, shoot the photo.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then somehow tile it all together to make it big. I forget how we did all that stuff before there were computers.
Yeah.
Xerox machines, stat cameras, stuff.
Uh-huh. And you enjoyed it. And photography obviously stayed with you in, like, a huge way.
In a huge way. That's, yeah. Like, I don't really read about graphic design so much anymore. Uh-huh. I read about photography.
Uh-huh. You're a bit of a doodler, and I guess illustration is more in your wife's domain.
Totally, yeah.
But you're definitely no stranger to, like, you know, making this a sort of cartoon or kind of little drawings and working by hand and stuff. So you're also a type designer, you know. You've released a lot of type, actually.
For me to say that I'm a type designer while sitting here with you, would be like me saying I'm a musician if Jeff Tweedy was sitting where you are, right? It's like, well, yeah, I can play a guitar, but that's not the same thing.
You might be selling yourself a little bit short, but okay, so I would be bummed to not talk about your font Big Cheese, because that's another Bob thing that really stayed with me. So what is Big Cheese, first of all?
So Big Cheese is the official description, I think, is 126 illustrations in font format. That's right. How the emigre folks described it.
Uh-huh.
And it was a collaboration between my old friend Eric Donnellan and I, and the original drawings are Eric's. So,
okay.
Like, this is back when phone calls even were super expensive, and uh-huh. people would exchange letters that they would write by hand on sheets of paper and send through the mail. And so Eric would have these, like, little weird drawings sometimes in the margins of the letters he sent me.
Right.
And I was pitching Emigre on a type face and happened to mention that I was interested in hiding, like, weird little dingbat things in the outer edges
glyph?
Yeah, the glyph, not of the glyph, but, like, substitute glyphs that, like, I didn't even know what the hell they were for.
Yeah. Deep in the character set.
Thank you. Yeah. Character set. See, this is why I said what I said about being a type designer. Anyway, the emigre people were like, we are not interested in your typeface, but these goofy dingbat things, if you could come up with a bunch of those, that could be cool.
Interesting.
So I pitched Eric on that, and we started working on it. And so he would send me drawings, and I would redraw them. Because mm-hmm. another thing back then is, like, font files couldn't be very large.
Uh-huh.
So... you know, I think you could only have 6 suitcases open at any given time. And this was System 6 on the Mac.
Yeah. What are suitcases, people are wondering?
Suitcases. So if you, PostScript type 1, right, there would be the screen font and the printer font. And so one of those two things was the suitcase. I forget which one.
Uh-huh.
And the memory on the Mac back then could only allow a certain number of those to be open at any given time. There was some kind of thing built into the system software.
So you make big cheese. You're kind of in the digitization department.
Yeah.
And Emigre, which is cracking at this time, is the coolest in the world.
Yeah.
And hugely influential. The magazine is happening. Yeah. And they released this set of dingbats.
Mm-hmm.
And it sells, right?
It did. It sold. I couldn't. Yeah, I think the first quarter it was out, it sold $20,000.
Okay, so you told me this years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, conversations about money didn't happen a lot between students and teachers. But this $20,000 a quarter figure really is scorched into my memory.
Yeah.
Like,
keep in mind, Eric and I did not get $20,000.
But it sold that. Yes, yeah. And your foundry split is 50% at that point, something like that?
Between Emigre and us?
Yeah.
I don't remember. But the split between Eric and I was 50%.
Okay. So then you're... And this is a dingbat font.
I know.
This is one style, right?
Well, it had upper and lower case.
That is crazy. I mean, for something to do, for a font like that to do those sorts of numbers now, it would be very, very impressive to me. And it was just stylistically, it was like a perfect thing for that time
period. For that moment, yeah.
Yeah, and you go back and look at the stuff that Emigre was putting out at that time, and you're like, oh my God, that's why the 90s looked the way it did. Or it was just such an important part of the visual culture.
Mm-hmm.
The way those goofy illustrations, the sort of like blobbiness to them and exaggerated proportions and stuff like that, it just kind of all makes sense when you put that against a whatever Jamiroquai music video or something. I don't know, like what another kind of similar thing might be. But that was huge for me to just hear that. Oh, you can make a font, and then it can generate actual money.
Mm-hmm.
And you did more. You did, like, serious undertakings, like Nuclear Era and stuff.
Right. That was for my own thing, Font Boy. Because I would keep pitching Emigre stuff, and they're like, you seem to have a lot of ideas about this stuff. Maybe you should do your own thing. Hint, hint. Please stop loving us so much.
And he did.
So I did.
And that's where Font Boy came from.
Yeah.
Was from Emigre rejections, essentially.
Yeah. Well, no, that was their suggestion.
Yeah.
They were like, hey, you could do this.
Uh-huh.
We did it. You could do it.
Right.
So I was like, well, if you say so.
And okay. He did.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a ton of time taking on a project like that.
It is a ton of time, and it never made the kind of money that first quarter of... Big Cheese did.
Uh-huh.
Never. And that's why I'm pretty much done with that. Because, I mean, to go back to our musical reference earlier, it's like if you get a record deal and, you know, the first record stiffs or the first single stiffs, then, like, the clock is ticking. Mm-hmm. But if the first record is, like, a giant, massive hit, that buys you tons of time.
Right.
And there was never any kind of hit like that.
Uh-huh.
It was also very hard to sell type back then because, like, those sales that Emigre had of Big Cheese, those were all through the mail.
Yeah.
Like, or you had to call them up on the phone and they would send you a floppy disk.
Yeah.
And that's just insane. And so for me to do that all myself, you know, I had to learn. Become like a credit card merchant.
Right.
So I had like the little machine that you would plug into your phone line so I could process credit cards. And there was a minimum every month. Like Visa and MasterCard would charge you a certain amount of money, whether you had any sales or not.
Uh-huh.
And I think only once ever sold more type than the minimum for Visa and MasterCard. And I was like, the universe is telling you something, pal. Like, come on.
And meanwhile, you're still doing books and identities.
And teaching and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not like you were going hungry. But it was still a huge time investment.
Right. Yeah.
I love the idea, though, that someone's Type Foundry is subsidized by graphic design process or practice.
Yeah.
I think it's actually pretty standard now, or it might be that way for a lot of folks. Even within, like, having a Type Foundry, like, for us, our experimental typefaces or whatever new kind of visual ideas we want to explore, they're always subsidized by the things that we can actually sell to corporations and stuff like
right.
that.
Sure, of course.
Those are always going to kind of lose money. Do you still design type?
No.
Done.
Nope.
Do you have any itch to get back into it?
I was never that good of a craftsman. Like, when I see the level of detail and craft that goes into, like, one of, like, Chris Sowersby's fonts, I'm like, I would have to drop everything and become a monk to get to that level. And it's just like...
It's bullshit, dude. I think you're selling yourself short again. But, I mean, it's a different kind of work, I guess. But yeah. It's the same... Mm-hmm. To me, it's very much the same thing as working in design or you know, taking a million photos so you get two or three ones that are actually decent, like... It does take a lot of time. For me now, I'm teaching people how to do this. It's kind of like it just has to get ingrained into your muscle memory, too. It's just the physical act of doing it and, like, the keyboard shortcuts and kind of having your proofing documents kind of ready to go. Like, if that's all there, then, you know, the problems are, you can solve them. It's just black and white.
Yep.
It's just two-dimensional. It's, but I don't know. I feel like type design is easy, but
it's not easy. Don't sell yourself short.
Well, I feel like it's fun. And the monk thing is true because it's meditative, you know?
Yeah.
Or that's kind of, so how does that work for you now? Like, where do you go for, like, when you want to unwind or relax?
I take pictures. I take walks.
Yeah.
And I take pictures.
Yeah, your Instagram is just all these wacky little scenes from, like, your immediate neighborhood.
Immediate neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. And then also, more recently, I've been taking trips specifically to take pictures.
Really?
So I've only been able to do that. Like, all the picture taking has always been around, like, oh, we're in Palm Springs for a vacation. So I would, like, always negotiate one day when I would get to, like, go out and do whatever. So it's like, oh, the Salton Sea's driving distance from Palm Springs. Uh-huh. Let's go there.
Yeah.
And so I would shoot a ton of pictures. Or, you know, I would go up into Desert Palms or whatever. Or what was it? Twin Palms? North of Joshua Tree in the desert, off towards the crazy, like, marine training base. There's, like, abandoned houses in the desert and all of this stuff. So anyway, but more recently I've been going on trips just to take pictures.
Mm-hmm.
So in the spring I went to Barstow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where it was hotter than I thought it was going to be.
It was like 110 or something.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It's so hot they have to have the world's largest thermometer. I think that's in Baker or something. But I went there to take pictures in the... there's like a desert preserve where there had been a forest fire, but the forest is a Joshua tree forest.
Uh-huh.
So I went there to take pictures of the burned forest. And then earlier in the pandemic, I visited all these different places where there had been wildfires to take pictures of the aftermath of the wildfires. Just with the idea that, you know, there's a photo project in here that I'd get to at some point.
Yeah.
But I find that very meditative. It's like you get to a place, it's like, okay, what's here? Where's the picture?
Right.
Like, what am I looking for? Or what's calling to me? Like, can I sort of empty my mind and just turn on my eyes.
Yeah.
To see, like, what's here. And then I just walk around and take photos. And, yeah. You know, when you're in the desert, you hope that, you know, you don't stay out too long and die of heat stroke.
Emptying your mind is the real great thing, I think. Uh-huh. I don't think I've heard it articulated that way, but that's totally in it. This book, How to Write One Song by Jeff Tweedy, that I'm obsessed with.
Is that a good book?
It's phenomenal.
Okay.
I think the sort of, it's all about songwriting, but the yeah. lessons are so easy to extrapolate into any sort of creative right. discipline. And at the beginning of it, Tweedy talks about the real purpose of all this is to disappear. And so I think that's kind of the same thing as emptying your mind or right. just like, yeah, yourself kind of disappears in mm-hmm. whatever you're doing.
Right.
And that's so good for just freshening up yourself mm-hmm. or your kind of thoughts.
Yeah.
You mentioned negotiating a day to go take pictures. So is this because you go off and leave your family for a day?
Yeah, totally.
You go solo to these days.
Solo.
And it's like an all day thing. You're not worried about the time.
I mean, I don't want to abuse the privilege. So it's not like I leave at 6 a.m. and come back at midnight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like take off around 9 and come back before dinner.
How old are you kids?
26 and 22.
Wow. Okay. So I dream about my kids being 26 and 22. It's on kind of like a similar age difference between my two girls, too.
Uh-huh. So we both have two girls.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. You're just like me in the future. It's amazing.
I hate to break it to you, James. You're going to be shorter in the future.
I can totally deal with that. I would not be bummed. Okay, so let me just bring you back to your kids being uh-huh. they're 4 years apart. Okay, yeah. So like 6 months and 4.5. Where was your state of mind with parenting and say the stresses or joys of childcare at that mm-hmm. point in your life? What was it like for you?
Well, the sleeping thing is not happening that well.
Yeah.
My favorite thing to do would be to read to them at bedtime.
Uh-huh.
I loved reading at bedtime.
Uh-huh.
It was so great. And we read so much stuff. When they got a little older, we would start doing like chapter books.
Mm-hmm.
Those Mr. Harriet books about animals.
Okay.
They'd be like, at a certain point, they would like ask for the chapter by name. Daddy, read the one about the dog who gets the ball caught in his throat. And I'd be like, oh, I don't know where that one is. And you just read it again. That was fun.
Was it fun because, okay, so we read every night to Loretta, PJ's too young for it, but I guess we could still read to her, but she's just going to. So for me, reading is, I'm almost at the finish line. Like today was hard. The house is a mess. We got laundry piling up everywhere. I need to make the lunch and unload the dishwasher and do a couple of other things to get ready for tomorrow. But after these three books, she'll be down and I'll be able to kind of do the next thing, you know,
right.
But you just adored the act of reading.
Yeah, the reading was great. Yeah. I mean, there would be some nights where I would fall asleep while I was reading.
Yeah.
Right? And this, of course, instead of making the girls fall asleep, would sort of wake them up. It's like, he's slurring his words and skipping sentences. This is great. Right? And then they'd wake me up, and I'd be like, ah, oh, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was almost like a reset. And be like, oh, man, I gotta... I keep going with this chapter. So there's that. That was fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing about working for yourself and having a flexible schedule is like I got to go on field trips.
You were into it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a little awkward because I think for men back then, I guess that was a little unusual. It would be like all moms and me, and and I would be, I think, kind of shunned. It's like, why doesn't he have a job?
Oh.
Why is he? How can he be here?
Oh my gosh!
Right?
How weird.
So I would eat with the kids.
Yeah,
it's like that's fine. They're more fun, clearly.
Yeah, I don't think that would happen. I think it'd be very normal to see.
I think now it's like whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that part was fun. SpongeBob SquarePants came out. Started like right around that time. And I remember accidentally like seeing that with my older daughter and being like, oh, we're going to be watching this.
How funny.
Yeah. There's a really early episode where they're like a bunch of jellyfish invade SpongeBob's place and they turn it into like a disco party. And to get him out, he like does some kind of like song thing, like Gary's eyeballs start, you know, going together in some kind of beat, and then they like turn this into a song. And then it turns into like some kind of like weird like psychedelic animation experience. I mean, if that's the first SpongeBob episode you see, you're like, you're hooked.
So all those people are just coming from whatever art school and then going to some kid's cartoon, and they're like, how fun can I make this for us, you know?
Right.
Now it is, for us, Bluey.
I don't know Bluey.
Well, why would you? Your kids are 22 or 26. You have no need.
They watch Bluey. Adventure Time.
Oh, Adventure Time is great.
I know.
I'm on board with Adventure Time. Stylistically, beautiful. I would say Bluey right up there with Adventure Time. Definitely check it out. And if you're going to start, this is on Disney Plus, which you might not be a subscriber to, but we definitely are. And the episode Baby Race is probably the best piece of television I've seen in recent history. But yeah, there are cool things that I really look forward to the opportunity to enjoy more stuff with Loretta and PJ that we can both kind of do instead of just only like look at that cute thing that you did, you know, which also,
no shortage
happens constantly. Yep. It's really all my wife and I talk about is what cute things happened today and how cute our kids are and how it's hard for us to not constantly tell them how cute they are. And that is the struggle. But it's so hard and it's so constant and it feels like there's no escape to it. So hearing someone talk about a day-long photo excursion on a family vacation, I'm like, oh my God, that sounds incredible. And absolutely, you should indulge in that as much as you can if you're not needed to change diapers. But do you long for those years of when your kids were young and more dependent?
I don't know. I mean, it was, that was fun, but now this is fun.
Yeah.
I mean, what becomes interesting is when they can finally express what they want.
Yeah.
Like, up to a certain point, it's like, we're going to SF MoMA. Everybody in the car. You know? And if there's any moaning, you're like, they have good pizza. Right? And so then you go. And what's great is at some point when someone says, there's a such and such show at SF MoMA. Can we go? And you're like, I'm going to cry.
Oh, my God.
Right?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, you know, that becomes interesting. Also, like, when they become interested in stuff where you're like, where the hell did that come from?
What do you mean?
Well, what do I mean?
Like Insane Clown Posse or something?
None of the girls were into Insane Clown Posse.
Well,
but you never know. But yeah, certainly the whole, like, what musical artists are you listening to? You know? Like, who knew I would like Portugal the Man?
Okay, yeah.
Right? That kind of stuff?
And you do genuinely like it. And like, you kind of can share something like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was funny with our kids. It's like, well, I don't know, maybe because pop music and rock and roll is sort of like embedded in everything now. But like when I was a kid, you know, the music in the house was classical music or like Bing Crosby kind of stuff. And so, you know, if you're playing prog rock or the Sex Pistols, you know, people are going to be a little unnerved. And now it takes like, it's like, yeah, okay. You know, that's what you kids like. Sounds pretty good. What's the hit? Just play me the hit.
What's your relationship with, how has your relationship with them changed now that they're adults? You know, they're adult adults.
Yeah, it's more like, you know, you're in advisory role.
Right, yeah.
We're just support staff now. And that's cool. You know, it's like, yeah, I mean, you don't want to over... The tricky thing is to not overstep one's bounds.
Start giving advice when you know you're not really called on for advice in that moment, that sort of thing?
Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, as you might imagine, we always have advice.
Right. Yeah, there's no shortage of advice.
It's like, yeah, that person as a romantic partner? No. Can we just say no? But of course, you're just you zip the lip, people. Either this will work out, or it won't, or whatever.
That's
or
we'll gotta be the Thanksgiving with people thing we don't in like, the world, or whatever. Though, that's tough.
Yeah, well, I didn't say I was good at any of this.
Oh my gosh, I can't even begin to wrap my head around bringing people home for Thanksgiving and. Yeah.
We have not had that yet. Okay. We haven't had like the, you know, I'm flying in with so-and-so for Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. We have not. Or so-and-so's coming and staying for Christmas. They'll be in my room with me.
Oh, that hasn't happened yet.
No.
Oh.
No, we haven't had that.
Could be around the corner, though.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that'll be cool.
Yeah. You're not going to say, hey. Separate room, buddy.
Oh my God, are you kidding me?
Hey, it happens in my wife's family a little bit. They're kind of some hardcore Catholic people over there. And even for, you know, people well into their 20s and stuff.
No, it's totally understandable. I mean, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's your house. We play by your value system, whatever it is.
Yeah. Sure.
But in our house, of course, Kathy's not here. Who knows what she would say?
What would she say?
She'd probably be fine.
So Kathy is kind of this mystery ingredient. I don't know if I've met her. And... Yeah,
Jeremy Mendy has often questioned whether or not she exists.
But she's an illustrator, mostly?
She's an artist now.
Artist, okay.
Artist.
Okay.
Yeah, she's a printmaker.
Uh-huh.
And... she makes large-scale monotypes.
So you were introduced to me as Bob, the designer teacher with a great sense of humor. Do you think someone would describe Kathy in a similar way?
I don't know.
But does she have your silliness?
She's probably a touch more serious than I am. I'm usually cracking her up rather than she's cracking me up. But I'm often in that mode of like, what can I say to crack Kathy up?
Right. That's the goal.
It's usually the goal. Mm-hmm. And I can definitely, like, one of my bad traits is pushing that too far. Like, just always going for the joke. Right? And it's like, dude, it's not joke time.
I love going for the joke in the absolute worst moment possible, or the darkest, saddest, most bleak moment. I think that's the real purpose of jokes. It's like, that's when we need them the most.
Right. But that might not be when the joke wants to be heard, I guess.
True, true. Yeah. I appreciate the effort, though, usually. Yeah. So she's making large-scale monotypes.
Yeah, a monotype is it's a printmaking process. You do it on an etching press.
Uh-huh.
But there's no etching involved. So you have a plate. It's usually a big piece of plexiglass that has ink on it.
Mm-hmm.
And you take a big honking piece of Reeves BFK paper that's damp.
Uh-huh.
And you put it on top and you run it through the press. And then the ink offsets onto the sheet of paper.
Uh-huh.
And then that's it. It's one shot.
Uh-huh.
So it's not like an etching where there's all these little lines engraved into something and you put the ink into it, and you can do an addition. There's no additioning. So each piece is a one-off. And she does these things with multiple processes. So now there's like, she's doing cyanotypes. You can get cyanotype emulsion and paint it onto paper and then expose it out in the backyard and then hose it off with a hose and then it dries and you've got, you know.
That's okay.
She runs that through the press. And I'm hesitant to talk any, because there's some stuff that I'm about her process that I'm trying to convince her. It's like, this part of your process is like intellectual property. You should not share with people how you're doing this part of what you're doing.
I mean, yeah, you have to specify. This is a typography or type design podcast at the end of the day. So if you mention monotype, there is a little bit more explanation that you have to do, but it's nice to know that this monotype has nothing to do with
the company buying up every typeface under the sun.
Yeah, yeah, they're really going for it.
Yeah.
Surprised they haven't approached Fontboy yet.
No, they don't need me, but I think you should have your price in mind for when they call, James.
You know what? It's such a weird thing because everyone has their price, and we can talk all high and mighty about it, but if they honestly were to come to me with some amount of money that meant I could be hanging out with my family whenever I want and working in the workshop as much as I want for the rest of my life, everyone has their price.
Absolutely, you know? Yeah.
I would say to the listeners, that hasn't happened. I'm not in any conversations with Monotype.
Monotype has not called either of us.
Definitely not. I would be completely shocked if they were interested in our library, which the sole purpose was to differentiate it from the Monotype library. So, yeah. Anyways, that's taken care of.
Yes.
All right. So, can we look in the future a little bit here? You're obviously teaching because you want to teach. Do you see a point coming up where you're like, you know, I'm kind of good on teaching. I've had a nice 33-year run and I'm set. Or are you like, I will teach until I can no longer teach?
Well, I turned 60 this year, so definitely these kinds of conversations are happening. And Kathy's older than me. So it's like, you know, we got to start figuring this shit out. Before, you know, one of us has an aneurysm and it, like, gets figured out for us.
Oh, God.
You know,
yeah.
Before some kind of horrible health thing happens.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm not quite sure. The joke I used to have with myself is that I would teach until the college told me I was done. Because the position I have, I get reviewed every 3 years. And so the other joke I have is that every 3 years, the college can fire me. and they have it.
Right.
So, but that's sort of a bullshit answer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure yet. It's still fun. So I can't really see when that would end.
It's still fun.
It's still fun.
Yeah.
I'm starting to think about, like, well, what other kinds, like, I've taught thesis and type two now for quite some time.
Yeah.
So part of me, my mind is like, well, what else is in the program that I'm good at that I could plug into and do something else?
You've taught writing too.
No, I never taught writing.
You did teach some design writing class. I remember vividly the poster you made for it.
No, I taught a class called Art Text.
Oh.
Which was an elective, and it was a upper division interdisciplinary studio.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't really about writing.
It wasn't writing?
No.
That was the whole point.
No, no. No, the way I got the class approved is that I said that it could conceivably appeal to writing students because text was going to be what we dealt with material in the class. So I taught it 1 year, and it was a nice mix of people. I even got some writers.
Uh-huh.
And it was really cool because, like, the design students would help the writers make stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh, this is working exactly how I wanted to. Uh-huh. You know, like, this one writer wrote all these pithy, snarky things and then turned them into bookmarks and stuff that she then went and, like, stuck in books randomly in the college's library. So if you'd be going through, you'd come across this bookmark and it would say on it, "Your art won't save you from death." I was like, yes, this class is great.
But that was the design class.
No, that was the UDIST class.
Oh, okay.
And then the second time I taught it, the word got out, and it was basically like a weird typography class because it was all graphic design students.
Ah, I see.
The second time. And then, and you can only do those classes twice, and then they don't happen again.
Okay.
So yeah, I couldn't teach writing.
I don't know.
That would be frightening.
What else? What do you teach? Is that kind of the question?
Yeah, the question is like, what else could I teach? Mm-hmm. The problem is, I look at the faculty who are in those things, and I'm like, well, this person's amazing. How could I can't. How could I do that or that? So I'm like, well, maybe type two. That seems like a good spot.
Is that some version of imposter syndrome thing, though?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably.
It doesn't matter who you are or how long you've been doing it or how skilled or how much experience. It just seems to infect everyone.
Everyone.
Yeah.
Everyone.
There's no way around that.
Yeah. I think the whole profession would be a lot more healthy if, like, the biggest idols of our profession would admit that.
Yeah.
Assuming it's even true. Maybe they're the biggest people because they don't have that. Who knows?
Well, it's just part of the roller coaster of emotions, I think, on any creative thing. Like, you're always taking a risk that you will hate the thing that you created, but at some point along that journey, you're going to question yourself to some degree.
Yeah.
It's a nice kind of break and a good reality check from thinking you're the shit, which also happens, you know, occasionally. All right, sweet. And your practice of just being, because we've talked a ton about you as a teacher because that's how I know you.
Right.
But at the end of the day, this is one day a week for you, or maybe even less sometimes.
It's part of 3 days a week.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's all these other days in the week, basically, when you...
There's the other seven.
Yeah, exactly. So, you're a traditional graphic designer, meaning you're doing print.
Primarily print.
Yeah.
Actually, let's be honest. I'm a print designer.
You always have been. And was there any... time where you entertained the idea of doing websites? Because this was starting to happen.
Oh, for sure.
When you started?
In the 90s, I did do interactive work using that fantastic tool, Macromedia Director.
Love it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, what can you do with buttons and loops? And it's like, you can do a lot of shit with buttons and loops. I loved that program. And the problem is, it was enormous amount of work to make a project.
Mm-hmm.
And the pay was terrible.
Really?
Terrible. Like, I was so thrilled when I got to do a project for a record company. And I was like, this is it. This is the career shift I've been waiting for.
Uh-huh.
And they were like, and here's the budget. And I was like, it's like, damn, I'm going to have to still do annual reports. So, and then, of course, the technology shifted to the internet from there, because those things were distributed by on floppy disk.
Crazy.
And, you know, I did do my first website. I coded it from scratch in HTML. Mm-hmm. But again, everything very quickly got very complicated, and it turned into things that were about giant teams. And so you either ramp up hugely or you join something. And I didn't want to do either of those things.
Yeah. Yeah. You stayed solo or with Kathy all these years.
Yeah.
And I remember another conversation with you in the library at CCA where you had the realization or you kind of had it in the back of your mind like, oh, if shit really hits the fan, I can go take a job somewhere, whatever, be a graphic designer. And then at some point you're like, hold on. I am no longer...
I'm no longer employable by anyone by myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like the safety net is gone.
Yeah.
And it's just, this is it.
This is it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've had the exact same feeling, you know, especially now, like our kind of income requirements as a family and everything. Like I can't go work for anyone, which is kind of terrifying. Yeah. But it's also great because you're like, okay, that's a constraint now.
Right, yeah.
So how do I...
Yeah, how do we work around this thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not employable.
Yeah, an old friend of mine that I know from years and years and years ago, I was talking to her and she said, Bob, we're like the last two koala bears on the last eucalyptus tree. I was like, are you sure about that?
But how does that make you feel? I think it's kind of an awesome thing. You,
how big is that tree?
Yeah, well, it's big enough, I
big
guess.
Enough.
It's it's like you got, you are the guy for what you do, you know? You don't go touting it around, but you're in the AGI. Like, does that kind of acclaim mean anything to you?
No. Not it doesn't. I mean, if you have imposter syndrome and these kinds of honorific things come your way, you're
which,
like...
Which is the highest thing in graphic design, right?
I don't know. It's not. Is it like the AIGA medal? Because that's not happening for sure.
I don't even know about the AIGA medal.
Anyway, whatever.
Okay, massive thing. Huge honor, whatever. Yep. If you have imposter syndrome, you start trying to reconcile the ways in which this was a mistake on their end? Is that what you were
pretty much. Pretty much, yeah. You're like, was it an off year? Were they just like, we need 75 more people who can pay 500 Swiss francs a year?
Oh my God.
I mean, what is it? Anyway, yeah.
That is so funny.
Well, here's a really funny thing about that. So every year they have what's called the Congress, where you get together with the members in some, frankly, insanely exotic place in the world.
Uh-huh.
I've been a member. I was voted in, I think, in 2011.
Uh-huh.
I have never been to the Congress.
Yeah.
I've never been.
You have no desire to go.
No, of course I want to go. But... I mean, first of all, it's fairly expensive because you got to get your ass to, like, South Africa or something. And then you, like, got to stay in whatever. Because it's a bunch of designers. Can you imagine the hotel that they've got picked out?
I'm sure it's sick.
Yeah. But can I afford that? And then the other problem is that it happens, like, during the semester. And it's like, I can't just, like, be like, hi, I'm going to a 10-day party. In New Zealand, can you guys cover for me?
That's when you gotta do what that guy did to you and just send in your sub.
Who's the sub?
I don't know. I don't know. If you go, though, I'll do it. You just call me and as long as it's not on Zoom. I can't do any more.
I think that's gonna be over, the Zoom thing.
Really?
The rumor I'm hearing is the spring we're back to all in person.
Are you done with it? Are you sick of it?
Well, I mean, last academic year, I was on sabbatical, luckily for me. And they were like, are you sure you want to do it? Because, you know, you have to write a proposal. And like 90% of what I proposed was going to be canceled because of the pandemic. And I talked to the dean and she was like, eh, and I was like, no, I still want to do it. Because I could still do, the thing I was most stoked about was this artist residency. And that wasn't going to be canceled because everyone could be separate. You live in your own little cabin and you have your own little studio and you could go the whole week without seeing anybody if you didn't want to. So I was like, yeah, I'll still do it. So I didn't have to do the completely asynchronous thing that my colleagues did last year. So
that's hard.
Yeah, I only had to do like the last third of the spring of 20 over Zoom. And in type class, things were far enough along. It wasn't that big a problem. And then in thesis, it's like, you know, whatever. So it that kind of went okay. But sitting in front of Zoom, like when the semester was over, I spent like a third of the summer going to the chiropractor every week because my back was destroyed from sitting there and being tense, you know, because you can't move. Like I realize that when I teach, I am never still. But when you're on Zoom, you got to like, you can move like back and forth a little bit.
It's
but you can't like get up and wander around.
It's so different. It's amazing that it's called the same thing or that it's still like teaching. I think teaching over Zoom versus in the classroom is going to attract a different type of person, maybe even a different type of student, kind of. You don't know if your jokes are landing at all. You can't, like, kind of form the same connections in a way.
Yeah.
It's all harder for me, and it was just, like, all worse. But the students still learn. Like, that was kind of the thing that I was impressed by, is that it didn't really seem to affect the quality of the work for us.
Yeah.
Which is a testament to them, for sure.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
Good for them.
All right. Well, I think we should probably wrap up, I guess.
Sure.
But
before we go.
Yeah.
Tell me about the turquoise Telecaster body that I see over on the other side of the workshop.
I'll tell you all about it. So Bob's pointing to a kind of primered, teal or surf green is the name of the color Telecaster body. That's on a jig that I've made for painting it. And I got into this project and quickly realized that doing a little DIY, like electric guitar kit, which is all it is just like they send you the parts and you put it together.
Oh, no kidding.
It's mostly painting. It's and trying to get a good finish on using spray cans. That's like a classic, like Fender high gloss kind of thing. Is
not gonna happen.
Nearly impossible. Yeah. People do it though.
Really?
And I got way into this YouTube rabbit hole, and it's kind of like it ends up being like 30 coats. And so I was like, shit, I gotta make a jig so I'm not trying to hold this thing. So I can spin it around. It's using all caster parts for the spinning mechanism.
Excellent.
And, I got like 20 coats in and then I got sucked into another project. So it's been up on the wall for probably 8 months or so. And it's not that far away from done. It's just like maybe 10 coats of gloss and the body's ready to go. And then, you know, those things are really simple to kind of just bolt on the neck and stuff.
Does the neck come already finished?
It does, except for the headstock is cut out into just kind of like a blank where you can cut the headstock into whatever kind of shape you want to do. So I was going to throw that on the CNC and cut out some cool shape and do like an engraving thing on it or something. It's a fun project that, you know, you have young kids and you just gotta make some hard decisions.
And you need a guitar.
I know. It's just so low on the list of priorities. All this shit is, though. It's like the things that I somehow justify in my mind. Bob, thank you so much
for thank you, James.
Coming to my garage and talking
this
to me.
This is great.
Thank you for being you and just, you know, you had a tremendous impact on my life in a really cool way, and it came at the perfect time for me.
I'm glad I did.
For that, I am forever grateful. So,
cool.
Thanks.
Thank you.
After my conversation with Bob, he walked me through a couple of the books that he's made during his sabbatical, which were full of really beautiful and often hilarious collages. I really think you should check out his Bob's Bookshelf series on YouTube. We'll link it in the description of this podcast. It's something I think every design student should see. Just a grown adult absolutely gushing about their love for the craft that they've been participating in for over 3 decades. It's just great and very inspiring to me. If you have a teacher that has really made an impact or inspired you well beyond your time in classroom, I'd say reach out and maybe even write them a letter or something. I definitely owe one to Bob. Today's episode was produced by myself and Jamie Otelsberg. Music is provided by Wolfpack, the world's funkiest rhythm section. I want to thank my cousin Louie that gave me an extra microphone so we could record this episode. Leave us a good review if you want. Buy our fonts if you want. Really do whatever you want, as long as it's not going to hurt anybody. Thank you for listening. We'll see you on the next episode.